This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 15th of February 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 293 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tugg.
Coming up on today's show, we're in Libya to get a glimpse of a forgotten era. A new exhibition in Oslo shines light on images of the country, showcasing its tumultuous and fascinating history from King Idris to Colonel Gaddafi.
Then writer and editor Anne Morgan has read one book from every nation on earth and has lived to tell the tale. She'll be here with that new book, Reading the World, Confessions of a Literary Explorer.
And later in the show, Studio 54 was once the most famous discotheque on the planet. We'll meet legendary Swedish photographer Hesse Persson, who spent years documenting nights on the dance floor.
All that plus our look ahead to the stories sure to set the news agenda in the week ahead. That's all starting right now. And it's nice to be back here. I've got one, I don't know whether this is normal, I don't think this is a headphone situation. I've got one hot ear, one cold ear. What does that mean? In terms of old wives' tales.
I don't know. What does it mean?
I think it means people are talking about you, doesn't it?
Or someone's put a cigarette out in one of your ears.
Exactly, which is not to be recommended. If there are any children listening to this programme, don't start doing it. Don't stick them in your ear.
Now, we had a nice lunch today, didn't we?
We did have a nice lunch today. We had lunch today with someone that came on the Monocle Weekly before Christmas time.
Yeah, Peter Mead of Abbott Mead Vickers, the legendary advertising guy. We got on well with him, and we took him out for lunch, actually.
Yeah.
And we've said we'll do it again. He's going to take us out.
I think presumably that's the understanding at this time. Yeah, exactly.
So this is a good recruiting ground for our lunches.
It's a good recruiting ground. Who do you think from today's show will end up having a, not really a boozy lunch, but an old-fashioned lunch?
I think Hasse Persson.
You think
Hasse? Yeah, I think he's going to be good. It was even nice in the introduction to say the word discotheque.
Yeah,
you don't get to say
I like
that.
The way you shortened. You weren't tempted to shorten
no,
that.
No, I thought no. Discotheque. That's yeah, a long time since I've been down to a discotheque.
Yeah, it's good. I like it. Hasse Persson certainly has a good. But we could take him up to a PO and Company in Stockholm.
Sorry. Yes, yeah, that'd be very nice.
That'd be decent. What about?
Well, Anne Morgan go anywhere. She's been around the world.
You made it sound like that. Like she's some sort of slatternly woman.
No, but I mean,
Anne Morgan. She'll go anywhere.
I think from Port Moresby to Bujumbura, she'd be a good date.
Port Moresby on the Monocle Weekend. This is great. This is a bit like what I'm doing with my new wife, taking her to all the what I'm calling the unexpected beauty spots of England. That's not a metaphor for something.
But Libya may be a bit more dodgy. A bit hard to go out for dinner at the moment in Tripoli.
I think so.
There's a very interesting hotel there, the Carinthia, which is featured in our dangerous hotel story. I stayed there once.
Yeah.
Then recently they had a terrible kind of shoot up there. So I think we'll stick with Anne and Hesse. They can show us a good time.
And it's very interesting, this dangerous hotel story. Is this just to do with bad service and sort of food poisoning, or is this
it was
trouble spots?
Trouble spots. Okay. It was a Steve Bloomfield special. So it was not... places like Kabul and Tripoli where, oddly, despite all the things going on, there are people who still want to kind of, you know, make a bed and serve you coffee in the morning, who believe in hospitality, even in these most kind of like bleak of places.
I'm not going to say what I was going to say. I think good. We should just wheel out. Good.
Because I know what might come. Yeah. So
I'm going to... Shall we wheel Thomas Edwards into the room?
Let's wheel him in.
From Monocle's editorial floor comes the world's hardest-hitting journalist.
Like a cuddly newsman. That's the effect I'm looking for.
He has uncompromising standards.
That's right, I'm setting the bar that low.
And is never afraid to expose new ideas. It's Tom Edwards with the news look ahead.
Sometimes you've got to stick with what you know.
Well, you don't know much.
The Brian Williams of Monocle 24, ladies and gentlemen. Tedwards is here.
How are you both?
Very well, thank you. How are you, Tom?
Yeah, not too bad at all.
Pretty good.
Sunday's treated me pretty well thus far.
We had some nice Austrian white for lunch.
Now, I thought you were looking a little jolly. It's a bit early in the day for that sort of thing, isn't it?
We took Peter Mead out for lunch.
Oh, well, you can't go wrong with that.
No. So, off you go.
Let's
hanging around. We've been having fun.
I'm sorry. I was end the fun. It's terrible, isn't it? I like to talk about dogs, Andrew. As you know, Crufts, the connoisseur's choice, of course, when it comes to dog shows. But in the US, the Westminster Kennel Club show is taking place tomorrow and Tuesday. Do you know, Andrew, you're like this. What is the breed of dog that won last year, 2014 Best in Show, Grand Champion?
Was it a wire-haired fox terrier?
It was.
No.
It was. Oh, Macy's kin.
That's not, I just like to remind the listeners that that's not what Andrew looks like. But he has one.
He does. Macy. Well, I don't know. He's got a kind of terrier like sensibility.
Demeanor, yeah.
But yeah, that was the.
Get off my leg!
After all, painting the sky.
That's the what? Name of it.
That was it's called Sky.
The Sky.
For short, apparently. Okay. Yeah, one last year. I'm a bit of a fox terrier.
Yeah,
you're, as well,
your
as you know,
family.
Your family stock. I mean, not. There's not literally dogs, but and there's all sorts of doggy related activity happening. So Bonhams, did you know this, Rob? Bonhams in New York, they do a special dog art sale.
Heard about this.
And they do it every year when the Westminster show is on. So all sorts of, from, you know, bizarre pieces. I think Charles Dickens's dog's collar was in the sale rooms last year. All sorts of things.
It's good stuff. And there is a law of returns on dog and cats in pictures. Like, there are lots of cats in pictures in paintings at major art fairs because cat gifts on the internet are popular. So people put a cat in there and it's literally...
Put a cat in there.
Oh, put a cat in there and people buy it.
Like a dog or, dogs or cats, you know, playing cards and that, wearing a hat.
Yeah.
Always.
Love those sorts
always
of things.
Popular. Enduring.
Let's just point out there is a dog gif at the moment where in a bad point in the afternoon, if Rob is tired, he will make Tom Reynolds kind of find it just to cheer him up.
Yeah.
It's a dog.
What is this?
It's a dog.
What's
a black dog sitting in an armchair, and it's like haunches on its back, on its bum.
It's like sat up like a human.
Like a human.
What's
and it's
up
sort
to?
Of watching the TV or something. Well, you can't see what it's looking at, but it looks really funny. It looks sort of guilty and funny and a bit annoyed and very anxious. It's hilarious.
This has not been brought to mind.
Have you not seen it?
No, I'm going to go and find
out.
You go
on dog gif. You just Google dog gifs, you'll find it.
Rob has literally seen it 1,000 times.
It doesn't. It's absolutely.
If it fills the heart with joy, you got to.
I'm a simple man.
Other US events.
Yep.
Mardi Gras parade in New Orleans on Tuesday. I've never been.
I'd really like to go to it.
I would love to go to that. It sounds completely crazy. You've got these crews, you know, who are the people who sort of are responsible for putting out the floats and stuff that goes by. The crew of Bacchus, that's the biggest, baddest float in all of New Orleans, apparently. I'd like to
go to New Orleans. I'd like to go to the jazz festival. Mardi Gras, there's quite a lot of heat around that. But we did a story a couple of months back about the nascent art scene in New Orleans, which is kind of exciting as well. I'm sold on that one.
You like
book
that?
Me a ticket. Yeah, I want to go.
And then I've just got you a batch of English Easterica.
Okay,
let's so a few of these. Well, one is kind of interesting. This is all, it has a kind of urbanist element, actually, Andrew. The London sewer networks, 150 years old. So, I mean, I have to mention Prince Charles. He's a bit of a... Well, you know, say what
a
you like.
A sewer aficionado.
Say what you like. He is going to visit a whole bunch of... People might have jokes that they can make themselves about this. He'll be visiting key points on the sewer system on Wednesday. The Lee Valley Tunnel, Abbey Mills Pumping Station, all of these big, important parts of the infrastructure.
I'm quite interested in that.
But 150 years, it's still amazing when you look back at the logistics, the infrastructure, the stuff that was made then, the fact that it is basically all that we still have now in the city. It's so incredible. And they're so beautiful. The pumping stations are incredibly ornate, beautifully designed. You know, they took such pride, even though no one was ever going to be there apart from... You know, maintenance.
I'd like to go on those trips. That sounds.
I think
good.
That sounds absolutely fascinating. Yeah. All built by really Bazalgette, wasn't it?
Yeah,
Peter Bazalgette, sort of presumably great uncle or something. Yeah,
I think it was his great.
A lot of people make that parallel as well.
Well, exactly.
Exactly.
I think that's
man behind Big Brother. There we go.
There's cheese rolling this week in Chester.
More cheese rolling.
More cheese rolling.
There's always cheese rolling, but this is one. I can't remember. Are you a Sussex man?
Yeah.
Are you from East Sussex?
No.
Oh, that's slightly ruined.
That's
that,
all right.
Should I still say
it's
it?
Quite nice.
No, it's rye. So it's rye-based scallop week. Now, I love scallops, but this is quite fun. So this demonstration of scallop cutting, there's all these records about how quickly you can get them out. There's a lucky scallop dip.
Oh.
Don't know. And then, this is my favourite thing of the whole week, there's a what a load of scallops race, which involves running to the fisheries and back with a wheelbarrow full of scallops.
That's so a lot of scallops.
Get on down to rye.
That is a lot of scallops, yeah.
Get on down to rye.
I thought they were really expensive scallops.
They are.
Kicking the scallops. Well, it'll be a good if you like scallops, it's the place to be this week.
What a load of scallops.
That's all I've got for you.
Thank you very much, Tom. That was a fine, fine dash through the world of news.
We begin today's programme in Libya with a photographic glimpse of two forgotten eras. The first, 1951 to 69, in the time of a kingdom that no longer exists. The second, a colonel's coup and the long dictatorship that followed. Both eras are explored as never before in a new exhibition at the Intercultural Museum in Oslo through to the 15th of March.
It's called Shifting Sands, Fragments of Libya's History from King Idris to Gaddafi. The photographs were discovered by a Human Rights Watch team who were in Libya documenting abuses in the country. Well, joining us now is Susan Glenn, who is the exhibition's curator. Susan teaches press photography and is a former photo editor for The Independent on Sunday Review magazine. Joining Susan in the studio is Ayat Menaina. Ayat's the founder of the Libyan Youth Movement and Libyan Youth Voices.
And before we get to Susan and Ayat, we thought we'd speak with Peter Burkhardt, Emergencies Director of Human Rights Watch. Peter was in Libya for almost the entire revolution in 2011 to document the human rights abuses when he and his team came across a vast paper and photo archive of the Libyan state. He told Monocle's Ben Rylan how they went about choosing which photos to save.
The problem was that we were in a race against time because the Libyan people, in expressing their anger against the Gaddafi regime, were systematically burning a lot of these archives. We collected these archives during a very active period of the conflict, when the outcome of the conflict was still very much unsure. We were faced with rooms full of photographs, shelves lined all the way up to the ceiling with photo albums and loose photographs. We photographed whatever we could, focusing on what looked important, but obviously we had to leave a lot behind because we worked on the principle that we would not physically remove any of these archives because they did belong to the Libyan people and not to us. We didn't really face any active opposition to us collecting the photographs or re-photographing the photographs. People were too busy with the conflict, which was raging all around them, and we tried to get to these archives as quickly as possible after various cities fell into the hands of the opposition. So oftentimes the buildings we would enter, the residences of Gaddafi as well as the security buildings, would be completely abandoned and empty, and we would just go around for hours looking for these archives and re-photographing them. On the few occasions where we did interact with people at these buildings, they were quite surprised at our interest in these archives. For them, Gaddafi had been this omnipresent dictator for decades, and they simply could not understand why we would be interested in images of a person that they so despised. Unfortunately, the conflict in Libya is still very much raging, and we believe that many of the archives that we visited now are actually destroyed. So this is one of the few intact records, both of the Gaddafi period as well as the King Idris period, which preceded it. I feel that we are the guardians of this archive. It is an important insight into a totalitarian dictatorship.
Well, that was Peter Burkhardt, who's the Emergencies Director of Human Rights Watch. And as advertised at the top of the show, we are going to speak to Susan Glenn and Ayat Menaina. So welcome both to the Monocle Weekly. And I suppose that interview with Peter there illustrates the problem. Maybe I'll speak to you. I'll come to you first, Susan, that we have here, in that a lot of stuff, a lot of interesting historical stuff was wanting to be destroyed by the Libyan population. But of course, history can only really exist when this stuff survives. It's the push-me-pull-you situation that I suppose you've had putting this exhibition in Oslo together.
Yes, I mean, when Peter first spoke to me about this archive, he reminded me that he had been in the situation of sitting on the edge of a country as it was about to collapse. And he witnessed the willful destruction of the cultural heritage of a country. For example, he witnessed this in Iraq. And so while he was sitting on the border waiting to go into Libya, he was very much aware that of the potential of this happening again. After all, he had witnessed this situation many times over the 15-year period that he'd been working in this kind of, in this way. I mean, the key thing from my perspective with dealing with these images was to try and attach the basic information, the who, what, when, where, and why to the images themselves. That was the kind of key problem that I faced. And one of the main problems with that is that Gaddafi pretty much closed the country down after the first few years in power. There was very little representation by Western media in the country, and so I had to sort of search for information from alternative sources.
All right, we should bring you in here. What's interesting is, you know, even now, 2011 seems a long time ago in Libyan history. As a Libyan who was living in Canada, or a Canadian Libyan living in Canada, when you look at this document, do you feel it's important? There are so many things happening today in Tripoli, in Libya. Do you feel that this is still, however, something we should be fighting to protect, so that, as you know, as Peter says, it will become a point when Libyans hopefully have a time to reflect on their history?
Yeah, I definitely think that this is kind of a vital role that Susan and Peter and Human Rights Watch are playing in order for us to really move forward and try to forge some sort of a future for Libya. We really have to understand where we came from and what the country went through, what happened during the kingdom period, which was largely hidden from the Libyan population under the regime, because he didn't want to remind Libyans of what preceded him and what he replaced, and kind of didn't want to give them any sense of an ability to compare, especially my generation. And then obviously understanding what Gaddafi kind of put Libya through would only help us kind of move forward together and also help with reconciliation and understanding.
Just bring you back in here. So obviously what's the tragedy of this also is, you know, the complicated element is that, you know, that, you know, Peter made this decision to leave the photographs there in the belief that they belonged in Tripoli, belonged in Libya. Is there a sense of, I wonder what would happen if we'd taken them all out and, you know, kept them? He must feel some kind of, you know, bit equivocal about it now.
Well, absolutely. And one of the things that the interview didn't really mention was that, I mean, his primary reason for going into the buildings was not to look for photographs, but to look for evidence, legal evidence of crimes against humanity, against the Libyan people. That was his primary objective. And it was in that process that he came across the photographs. So, I mean, his mind was first and foremost finding evidence for prosecuting the regime members. That's what he was primarily looking for. And of course, when the other reason that he found the photographs was so very interesting was to discover whether any of the photographs themselves contained information or evidence which could prove, you know, crimes. And fortunately, there are some very valuable photographs in that sense.
I wanted to ask, I mean, this sounds like a very sort of far-reaching exhibition, both of you actually. Just as there are moments of ugliness and of brutality, there are obviously moments of great beauty in this show as well. Presumably there are amazing images of Libya, a place that people haven't seen enough of, because Gaddafi wouldn't let there be any photographs unless they were of him looking particularly handsome and in his various different uniforms. So what else do we see in this show?
Well, that's a very interesting point. I mean, as you pointed out, the exhibition is in two parts. Mm. The first is of the Kingdom of Libya period, and the second is of the Gaddafi era. The Gaddafi era images, I would say, are purely propaganda. There are no street images from that era.
So this is Gaddafi wanting, I mean, he, as you say in your notes to this exhibition, was very forward-thinking in his use of image, whether that was out of vanity or politics.
One of the interesting documents that I found was, during my research investigating the archive, was a proclamation, a declaration made by the Revolutionary Command Council very soon after the coup. I think it was dated December 1969, or it might have been 1970, and there were declarations to the general public, and the very first one, the first clause was to do with making propaganda. And it didn't specify what they meant by propaganda. So by making it loose like that, it made people very nervous about taking pictures. So essentially, the photography that took place that we found from the Gaddafi era is under the direction of the Gaddafi regime.
So it's all propaganda or
exactly.
Surveillance. But so it must
exactly.
be the most under-photographed country in the world, pretty
Absolutely.
Much, during those
yes.
years.
Yes, I mean, you know, the general population felt comfortable photographing their family and family celebrations. But I certainly haven't found anything other than that.
We should bring you back in. I'm not sure what your family's story is, but when you and your family look at these images, obviously we're hearing that what the filter is if you're an outsider looking at them. But when you've looked at them, what story of Libya do you see?
Definitely just hearing about the archive being put together and that it was first shown in London when I was here. There's this insatiable curiosity on my part that I really wanted to see this Libya that I personally was kind of kept away from for most of my life and didn't really get a chance to know. And also this period that all of Libya was kind of distanced from, the kingdom period, that my family always spoke really fondly of growing up. So I was really interested in kind of getting a more in-depth insight into that, but also kind of being able to look at even the Gaddafi regime era kind of on my own terms. I, you know, willingly went to the exhibit and I chose to look at these images and kind of was able to assess them knowing that this was over. So for me, that was almost therapeutic, an experience. And I'm also, you know, really curious with the details that kind of Susan is going to continue to unfold with the context of the photos and the various events. These are things that if they were recorded anywhere, you know, had a very heavy agenda to them. And so to look at them without any bias and just purely as history is going to be something that I really look forward to.
Yeah, and that's a question I'd like to ask both of you, actually, is whether these two mini collections of images, I suppose, that are in this exhibition, and Peter Burkhardt's more political, militaristic choices and Tim Hetherington's more perhaps moments of accidental beauty that he found, which, I wonder, do you think promote the idea of helping set Libya free from the aggression that it's suffered? Aya, first.
I mean, I think as difficult as it may be or as painful for some people, I think just confronting those images of the regime era and analyzing kind of the various stages that it went through. And the initial exhibit that I saw in London kind of was a sequence of rooms and it kind of went chronologically. And just to observe the transformation through the years was, you know, eye-opening. And I think that's really important, especially young people my age only got to see, you know, the Gaddafi that existed in the 90s and onwards. And he very much had complete control and didn't witness necessarily the vicious crackdowns and the violence that kind of took place in the 80s where, you know, my parents were students and they were kind of part of the student unions and things like that. So they entered a Libya that was already closed off and nobody was willing to move until 2011 when people took to the street.
And Susan, do you think the same, or do you see these moments of, as I said, accidental beauty as being a great way to promote a further understanding of the country?
First and foremost, I think what is truly interesting about this collection and something that I'm really passionate about is that essentially this is about, these photographs were taken by Libyans. They were obviously recorded by Peter, Tim and Michael, but they're essentially Libyan photographs. So I think that is essential, that it's Libyans photographing their own history, which I think is extremely valuable. And this is why I have always avoided including subsidiary collections to be added to this. It needs to be something very specifically Libyan, because
photojournalism always has an axe to grind, doesn't it?
Well, it's not so much that. I think for a country that has had a vacuum in terms of its own identity, we have the luxury of either embracing or rejecting our nationality, our Britishness or Canadianness or whatever it is. But the Libyans have had a vacuum because it was deliberately taken away from them. It was obscured. So I think for them collectively to be able to look at their own history together and say, yes, as we may have huge differences between us, we may be on opposing sides, but generationally we live through this together. And this experience, these events are something that all of us live through.
Susan Glenn, curator of Shifting Sands, Fragments of Libya's History from King Idris to Gaddafi, and Ayat Mnena, founder of the Libyan Youth Movement and Libyan Youth Voices. Thank you both very much for your time today. Do you know what we're going to have? A Studio 54 theme?
I don't know.
That, after all, is not what's coming up next, but is somewhere else in the show.
Yeah, but I don't know, but you've made me put on hot pants and a boob tube, so I'm intrigued
to
know.
So let's make it well worth it. Let's have Donna Summer, I Feel Love. This is pretty iconic stuff. Hit it, Claire. And I'm glad there isn't a webcam in the studio for that one. I don't know whether you call that shimmying, but certainly you need to tuck yourself in, Mr. Tuck. That was, of course, Donna Summer and I Feel Love.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly. Later on in the show, we'll get an insider account at the world's most famous nightclub, Studio 54, from the legendary Swedish photographer Hasse Persson. But first, we meet writer and editor Anne Morgan, who's undertaken a social and literary experiment of gargantuan proportions.
In an attempt to uncover the meaning of national identity and cultural heritage, Anne decided to read a single book from all of the world's 196 independent nations, and maybe two or three others too. The books range from novels to biographies, poems to memoirs.
So how long did it take? What did she learn? And does she have a favourite? Well, we caught up with Anne just a little bit earlier here at Midori House. And welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Reading the world is such a good idea. How come no one did it before?
Well, I think that's probably partly because...
Because it's a lot of work.
Well, it is a lot of work. That's certainly true. It wouldn't have been possible, actually, sort of, you know, 20 years ago, actually. Yeah. It's something that had to happen with the internet. So there's possibly an element of that. I think that there are actually a number of people out there doing literary quests of one kind or another online and using the internet as a resource and a way of finding things. But no one else has been mad enough to try and do the world in a year, as far as I know.
Well, what I like about the introduction to the book, the first couple of chapters, is, in fact, you were kind of doing that already. You were doing the equivalent for women's literature.
Yeah.
And then some cheeky person started sending you an email.
Yeah, exactly. It was a comment that a blogger in America put on my blog, and he said, oh, I've got a book you must read. I really want you to read. And the blog at the time I was doing was called A Year of Reading Women. And he said, yeah, you've got to read this book by an Australian writer. It's called Cloud Street by Tim Winton. And I thought, well, I'm reading women, so not really fit the brief. So I said, oh, well, thanks. I'll put it on the list for next year. And he wouldn't let it go. He wanted to know, well, what was I going to do next year? Because, you know, he wanted to know what I thought of Cloud Street and I'd have to do a blog about it. And I said, well, I would consider doing another blog, but I just need some sort of angle. You know, I don't want to just do, you know, random book reviews. So he said, well, what about reading books from different countries? And I thought about it. And the year coming up was 2012, which was obviously a very international year for the UK with the Olympics and the Jubilee and everything. So I thought, well, why not use this international time as a time to go out and meet the world through books? And what about a book from every country? That's when it starts to get interesting. You know, what would that involve?
Although then you even had trouble deciding how many countries there were
and
drawing up a list of countries.
Well, that's right, because there's no one answer to the question, how many countries are there in the world? It depends on your politics. It depends on where you live and what you believe. And so, you know, the number can vary from anything from, you know, 66 MOOC countries up to as many as 280 national flags in the world. And it changes all the time.
You chose the shorter list.
I chose a somewhat shorter list, yeah. In the end, I went for UN-recognised countries, but I also added in Taiwan because it used to be a UN member. And then I, in the end, did an extra territory which was chosen by blog visitors, which ended up being Kurdistan.
And do you use the same sort of critical faculty, the same apparatus, whether you're reading an American novel written in English as opposed to a Taiwanese novel? By that question, I mean, are you expecting novels from certain places to be about certain things? And were those expectations unfounded?
It's a very interesting question. Something that...
Not a long and not very good one, but thanks for...
No, it is an interesting question, because actually something that I encountered again and again among people who came to the blog was that they were expecting that I was somehow looking for the spirit of a place. Now, I had a problem with that, because for one thing, I don't think one book can sum up a country. It's one very partial story.
And you shouldn't really look for ones that
exactly,
do.
Exactly. And the other thing is, if I've never read a Mongolian novel and I've never been to Mongolia, how on earth do I know what the spirit of Mongolia is? Yeah. So I would just be going on some sort of half-baked stereotype lodged in the back of my mind from an advert I might have seen 3 years previously and thinking, does this book conform to, you know, this thing that I believe, which may not be true at all. So really, for me, it was actually about discovery. It was seeing what was out there, what voices could I find, and how does that influence my thinking?
So I know from the book that, you know, people ended up suggesting books to you, and there was a kind of bit of a passing on, a chain of things. But were there spots on the earth that you actually found it, one, difficult to find a good book that you wanted to read, and two, that was available in a language that you understood?
Yes, absolutely. I was only reading in English. I can read French and German very slowly with a big dictionary. But
that's not a way to get through a lot of books, is it?
It's not. And also, actually...
I'm like that in English.
And also, actually, I decided before I started the quest that actually... if I did use my other languages, it would make the project just about me, whereas actually I wanted it to be about, can a person in London read the world? So I thought I'll stick in the language that most Londoners read, which is English. Yeah. So that meant finding translations. And actually, yes, you're completely right. So some countries, there was very little and even sometimes nothing commercially available in translation, which meant that I ended up prevailing upon the kindness of strangers around the world. In a number of cases, I was sent unpublished translations of things that sometimes people had done for fun or as students or just for their own interest. And then in one particular case, the tiny African island nation of Sao Tome and Principe, having exhausted every avenue I could think of, having emailed doctors on placement there and students on gap year and charities working there, anyone who might have an idea about something, and not found anything, I ended up putting an appeal out for volunteers to translate something for me. And within a week, I had more people than I could involve in the project. Nine strangers, or rather eight strangers and one person I was at school with years ago and hadn't seen for years, who I found a short story collection for, and sent it out to them and asked them each to translate a few of the short stories. And within a month, I had the entire book to read, which was really humbling. And in fact, one of the volunteers was Margaret Jewel Costa, who is one of the world's most famous Portuguese language translators. So that was an extraordinary experience.
Before we get onto the interesting world of translation itself, which I'm sure now you're up to your elbows in, I wondered very simply which gems you found. I mean, presumably publishers must be not only your own, but publishers must be wanting to know about the hot new so-and-so from Taiwan, because this stuff does not get often published and
That's
printed
right.
in England or in the US.
Yeah, well, for me, one that really stood out was a book from Mozambique called Uelelapi, which had won a National Book Award and had been voted one of Africa's top 100 books of the 20th century by an African jury. But it's not available in English. It was written in Portuguese. And the writer's name is Ungolani Barkarkoza. And I happened to, through a rather long-winded process of asking lots of people what I could read from Mozambique that wasn't Mia Kuto, because he is about the only widely available Mozambican author in translation, I found this guy who had translated it, and he sent me this unpublished translation. And I read it, and I was amazed by the book, because not only had it had all these accolades, but actually it was an extraordinary piece of work. It had this towering central character who's a tragic hero of the stature of King Lear or a Okonkwo, and amazing imagery, really startling, thought-provoking imagery, unlike anything I'd come across before. And I just thought, this is extraordinary that, you know, this stuff isn't, we don't know anything about this because it's just not in our field of reference. We can't access it.
Now, you've woven the book together, not in a, we should explain it for listeners, it's not done in a, there's not a chapter per nation. You've kind of woven it together in a much more fascinating way. But it is amazing. I was looking earlier today, and you got to the bit on, I think it's on Tuvalu, and there's a note from the president saying how proud he is to have a novel, in the local idiom, or written by a Tuvaluan. When people pick this book up, do you want them to use it as a bit of a reader for things around the world? Do you want it to be a kind of a history of literature? What was your overarching ambition for the book?
I think it's really a document of how a quest like this can change you and how reading more widely can change you. I mean, for me, it was a life-changing experience in many ways, not just because of the extraordinary books I read, not just because of the numerous connections with people around the planet that I made and friendships that last in many cases to this day, but also it changed my thinking. And that is a big thing, I think. It revealed to me the assumptions that a lot of our stories rest on, and also the assumptions that a lot of other stories rest on, and how you can look at things very differently depending on what your background and your frame of reference is. So I suppose it's a record of that, of how reading can change you. In terms of it being a reader, I think if people want recommendations, they could go straight to the blog, because they've got on the blog, there's the list, not only of all the books I read, but all the books that people have recommended to me and continue to recommend to this day. And also all the reviews. So you can click on a country and see what I read and what I thought of it and how I found it. So in terms of looking for book recommendations, I would say the blog is the place for that. But in terms of what the project actually
what reading did, does to you.
Yeah, exactly. What reading does to you.
A slightly tangential question. What always worries me about when I read 10 books, let alone all 190 odd, is how little of it actually stays with me. There's a residue that stays. Often it's more a feeling or a mindset when I look at a book. I don't remember. But you seem to have an extraordinary way of cataloguing information. You know, we can ask you about any country. You seem to know still the author and what the book was about. Is that a unique personal skill that you know? But it's interesting how your mind works. Were you the perfect person for this book? Because you can actually retain information in a slightly intriguing way, in a better way than I can. Anyway.
Thank you. Well, I think part of it, the reason I can recall the books is because I blogged about them. So there are loads of books that I've read more recently that I can't remember in anything like the detail that I can remember these books, because I read them and then planned and wrote posts about them. And then I still to this day get people putting comments on the different reviews. And so I have discussions about these books on a regular basis, you know. Yeah. So I think that's one reason. I suppose I do have good data recall, although I have to say sometimes when I see, because I always know someone comes up to me and they have a particular look and I know they're going to ask me what I read from a particular country, and it feels a bit like a literary Kim's game, you know, and I'm just, and my brain, I get this voice at the back of my head saying, you're not going to remember. And most of the time I do remember, but it's that kind of, does feel a bit like a test sometimes.
How interesting it is talking to Anne Morgan. The book is called Reading the World, Confessions of a Literary Explorer.
After the break, we're back to the heady and sweaty days of 1977. Oh yes, I feel love. In the world's most famous club, an insider account of Studio 54 is right after this.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
There are a few nightclubs more well-known, more mythical, more legendary than New York's Studio 54. Back in the late 70s and early 80s, it was the place to be, both for celebs and the people who wanted to be them. And one man who was there on the dance floor throughout it all was Swedish photographer Hasse Persson.
Hasse spent years capturing the magic of Studio 54 in now iconic pictures. Hasse has just published his photographs from that era in a book form for the first time. We caught up with Hasse earlier from his home in Sweden.
Hasse, thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. Now, this book looks absolutely beautiful. It looks handsome. It looks slightly debauched. It looks all the things that we know Studio 54 should be. How on earth did you manage to have a good time and keep your camera pointed in the right direction?
Well, I'm basically a photojournalist, and I was covering world events, wars, and Oscar nominations and all that stuff. So this was an assignment that I gave myself. I was going to have a big exhibition in Stockholm, and I wanted to do something special. This goes back to 1979. And so I was focused on what I was doing, and I must say, the temptations at the place was enormous. So I'm glad I had a camera to hold on to.
Yeah, it's everyone needed something or someone to hold on to. And it's a beautiful book, and it is very diverse, and it gives a kind of very, I guess it gives a very true story of the diversity of the sorts of people that made up the crowd at Studio 54. I wondered how it worked practically, whether you had an understanding with the doorman. It was notoriously difficult place to get into, especially back in its heyday in the late 70s there. Did you always manage to get in? What was your secret?
Well, Steve Rubell, who owned the place, and he was the dictator of the place, he gave me free access to take pictures in there. I think he had a secret dream that somebody would record the place for the future, and that somebody was probably me. I don't know if there were any other photographers that could go in and out at their own wish. So I was allowed to bring in my camera. I was also allowed to get in. I didn't have to stand in line. I never paid an entrance fee or anything. So I just walked freely in the place, and I documented what I felt like. I wanted to get the spirit of the place. I was not a paparazzi photographer. There were some famous Ron Galella type of guy that crushed places and took pictures. I was just the opposite. I just wanted to record mainly unknown people. I didn't want to have too many famous faces, because that puts a time limits on the photograph. So I wanted to photograph the spirit of the place, and Steve Rubell apparently liked it.
So what's also interesting is, it's quite hard to understand why this club and this moment has become so celebrated in pop history, in contemporary, history of the time. But I wonder if it's because when we look at your pictures and look back, here are kind of celebrities, the likes of Calvin Klein and Liza Minnelli, Brooke Shields. And we know that after these pictures were taken, the events that would unfold in their lives often not the happiest of events. And we also know that this is a period pre-AIDS. There's a wonderful innocence to these pictures. Do you think that perhaps, your photos are even more powerful because of the events that followed?
Yes. I think when you use the name innocent, that's what I feel also. Even though, people made love up on the balconies, and there were lovemaking in the men's room and ladies' room, and actually quite frequently, but it was, in a way, innocent also, and someone has said that Studio 54 existed between after the pill, before AIDS, and while you still thought cocaine was a health product. So it was an unbelievable time. Of course, AIDS closed down New York City, in 81 or something like that, and then this party was over. And I think probably one of the reasons why it has become so famous is that it actually only lasted for about 1,000 nights, which is a short time. And all those nights were magical events. I mean, I could go there on a Tuesday or a Wednesday, and it was like magic every night. And Steve Rubell was like a magician to put together this group that made the magic, and he had this idea about a tossed salad. He told me once that he wanted to have about 20% should be gay, because women love to see men dancing, and he wanted that 5-10% should be lesbians or transvestites, because the male audience basically thought it was very exciting to see women kissing. And then it should be famous and rich people from the United States. But also, he wanted to mix in street kids from Harlem and the Bronx, because Calvin Klein or Halston, they wanted to see what's the next ideas in street fashion? And then Steve Rubel wanted to have people from South America, particularly Brazilians. They were good at dancing. And then he wanted Eurotrash. Eurotrash was English people, you know, redhead people from England that had a funny dialect. And also Scandinavians, you know, they hardly spoke any good English at all. And then, you know, princes and princesses from south of Europe. So there was a mixture, and he managed to get that mix almost every night. So it was a magic place, and people, when they walked home in the morning, they had a happy smile on their faces.
And Hasse, do you think that you were part of Steve Rubel's tossed salad in that sense, that you weren't a photographer with an axe to grind from the Bronx or from the Upper East Side, that you were part of this strange and magical mixture, and that you could bring a different eye to these photographs? Did he see something? I mean, did he ask to see the photographs that you'd taken to make sure that they conformed with his own idea of his nightclub? Or was it only after these 1,000 nights that you sat down and showed him some pictures?
You know, he saw some pictures in the very beginning, but then he didn't care. He trusted me. He wanted me to be around. And of course, you know, since I was a photojournalist, I could sometimes bring in, you know, famous tennis players with long hairs, and or a hockey player or a movie star and so forth. So he thought that I should belong to that inner circle of people that made this place moving. And of course, you know, Andy Warhol was part of this, and I sometimes came in his company and so forth. So he thought that I was a guy or one of the people that should document the place. And since he also trusted me in the sense that I wouldn't sell this to Paparazzi magazine. So sometimes, you know, I used wide angle, so I walked straight up to people. I was very close, like 1 meter or 2 meters away, so everybody was aware that I was taking pictures. And sometimes I got a signal that, no, I don't want to be photographed tonight, or I don't look right tonight, or I'm in the wrong company tonight. So then I just walked away. So I didn't want to make a mess out of myself, and so I was kind of careful when I worked there.
And tell me, perhaps of all the images and all the legends about that nightclub, the arrival of a white horse on the dance floor for the Halloween party has become the most legendary moment of them all. And you were there to capture that as well. Tell us about that moment.
The original white horse is probably the same horse was at the private party for Bianca Jagger. But that was a private party, and I didn't attend that party. So at Halloween, that horse appeared again. Now not Bianca. Bianca was dressed, but here comes two undressed girls on the white horse. And that's made a funny picture, I think.
I didn't realize. So the horse was a regular at the front door as well. The horse was often in the queue to get on the dance floor.
You know, there was in Andy Warhol's expo. Andy Warhol was probably the main character at the place. If I was there about 100 nights taking pictures, Andy Warhol was there basically every night. So he, and I, in his book, The Exposures, he talks about, you know, having nightmares that he wasn't able to get into Studio 54. And he put some advices how to get in. And one of the advices was that you should come with Halston. Halston was at the time the world's most famous haute couture designer. He was the one that dressed up Jackie Kennedy. So if you came in Halston's company, you were safe. Another way to get in was to come in a helicopter or an ambulance. Then you could get in. And also, if you were different, you know, one of the most famous people at Studio 54 was Sally. And Sally was 77 years old when her husband passed away. And she was complaining to her children that now life was over. And then the children said, no, mommy, there is a new discotheque called Studio 54. Why don't you try to get to Studio 54 and start all over again? And she did. She dressed up. She bought new glasses. And she took a cab to Studio 54. And when Steve Rubel saw her outside the discotheque, he said, let the lady in before she dies. And Sally became very, very famous. And she was called Disco Sally. And she traveled all over the world opening discotheques after this. And she died on the dance floor at Studio 54 in a heart attack at the age of 80. So she had 3 good years before she passed away.
Man alive, I wish that I was born earlier than 1977 so that I could attend it as well. Hasse Persson, congratulations on the wonderful Studio 54. That book is out now. And thank you very much for your time on the Monocle Weekly. And that's it for edition 293 of the Monocle Weekly, Andrew.
And very fine disco bald one it was.
I'm glad you kept your little all-in-one mankini on, whatever it was, for the entire show after the first track. The first couple of guests talking about Libya wearing such a thing is tough, but you managed to pull it off.
Especially when the rollerblades were chafing my heels as well.
And I'm managed to get the riding a white horse metaphor into the Studio 54 discussion. I don't think anyone knew what you meant there at all. It's
no, good. But I didn't realise that a horse had made 2 appearances.
Yes, it's Bianca Jagger. Bianca Jagger rode in on a white horse for her birthday, and then these naked girls, Lady Godiva-esque presumably, rode in at some other point.
That horse was cleverer at getting in than poor old Andy Warhol.
Yeah, maybe he was a Trojan horse. Maybe he had many.
Yeah.
Well, a very, secret stuffed inside him.
And I loved that tale. That was good.
If you were Sam in Quantum Leap and you could have cut your fingers and gone anywhere.
What is funny is that thing we were saying is that these images of these people we now see as either dead or rattled. You know, and they're all looking kind of fresh-faced and joyous. They don't know all the events that were going to unfold in their lives. But the other strange thing is that you see photographs of people leaving nightclubs now, and you see the occasional very posed things. But these photos are something different. They're really kind of documentary in style. It's really a wonderful set of pictures.
Yeah, you don't see that. I presume that people that maybe just in that nightclub, or maybe it was that period of time, had a much different sense of their sort of self-worth of their image, perhaps, or even people that were the biggest rock stars, the biggest film stars of their day, were kind of proud to be photographed pretty much anywhere.
Yeah, and there's no publicity person jumping in the way saying, don't take a picture. It's just strange that it's celebrities' ease with being in public and being photographed at the same time.
We love it. Now you can take your rollerblades off.
Thank you.
Have a nice walk.
Oh, that's
have a nice walk with Macy around Regent's Park.
Thank you.
Today's show was produced by Daniel Jacopelli, and our studio manager was Claire Urban. And we'll be here same time, same place next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.